One, two, three, four, go.
I want to have a food court love. So meet me at the Wetzel's Pretzels, girl. I'm coming at you like a hot dog on a stick. So be my Panda Express.
Stop, stop, stop. I've got blood coming out of my ears. That's how bad you are. How many times do I have to explain? Next in Line has the chance to be the greatest boy band of this era. But not if you sound like a freaking kennel.
But please, we've been rehearsing this song for 62 hours. Can I just please call my family?
We are your family, okay? Next in Line is your family, okay? You have no other family, okay? Hey, you.
Excuse me?
What's your name?
Greg.
Wrong.
Ow!
Your name is Zach now. Greg is not a cool name. You're Zach now. That guy, he's Ashton now. And that guy, he's Liam. And this guy... I'm sorry, who are you?
My name is Tucker. I'm not actually in this band. I was trying to use the studio next door, and I got trapped here for the last...
Oh, you are in the band. Everybody is in the band until I say they aren't. You are now part of Next in Line, and you can keep your name because it's cool, but hand over your wallet, your cell phone, and your belt.
Can we talk about doing a version of Finishing the Hat, you know, by Sondheim?
No. Do you not even understand what a boy band is? Boy bands do not do Sondheim. Boy bands dance and do songs like Food Court Love, which is going to be a huge hit. Do you know what else boy bands do?
What?
Exactly what I tell them to do if they want to see the next sunrise. Now, whoever went to the bathroom in his pants, go get cleaned up, and we'll take this from the top. In the meantime, you listen to the show about boy bands. And now, the tambourine player in the Free Credit Report band... Colin McEnroe.
The thing is that I've actually had Food Court Love stuck in my head all day long since we did that. All right, so today we are going to talk about boy bands. Now, what are boy bands? What do we even mean by that? Before I even introduce some of our terrific guests, and we have great guests for you today, I think maybe one thing we could just do is just play a little bit of the latest boy band. This is One Direction. I have to be careful because I keep wanting to call them One Dimension, which I think is some kind of Freudian thing. But anyway, this is called Kiss You, right? Kiss You? Kiss You. All right, here's Kiss You.
Oh, I just want to take you anywhere that you like. We could go out any day, any night. Baby, I'll take you there, take you there. Baby, I'll take you there, yeah. Oh, tell me, tell me, tell me how to turn your love on. You can get anything that you want. Baby, just shout it out, baby, just shout it out, yeah. And if you want me to, let's make a move, yeah. So tell me, girl, if every time we touch, you get this kind of
right. There must be something wrong with me because I actually kind of like that. And I even like the video. And I'm 58 years old. And that's sad. But that's the way things are. So we're going to talk a little bit about this. We're going to talk about the phenomenon of the boy band. Boy band probably does start with the Monkees, who I also really like a lot. But I imprinted on the Monkees at the appropriate time, at least. So that makes a little bit more sense. Joining us right now, Amanda Hess, writer and editor in Los Angeles. She blogs for Slate Magazine's Double X on sex, science, and health. And she likes boy bands, too. Just a second, we're going to add Maura Johnson, also writer, editor, and music critic who writes for the New York Times and Spin. But let's start with you, Amanda. I sense reading your work, you don't have a big problem with One Direction.
I don't. I'm a little bit obsessed with them. And I think part of it has to do with, you know, they sing pop music and that's really designed for humans to like it. So I don't feel so bad about that. But I'm also really kind of obsessed with them as a phenomenon. And I think a lot of young women are too, even if we sort of see their love for them as sort of one dimensional.
I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I'll bring this up right now. I get this fascinating email from somebody named Jen Cook, a listener named Jen Cook. You know, there's sort of a denigration of boy bands, and there's sort of an assumption, an implicit assumption that this phenomenon is manufactured and therefore aesthetically barren. And it's not an assumption that everybody shares, but I mean, one hears it a lot. And I sort of wonder, she actually quotes Nick Rhodes of Duran Duran, who says something to the effect that this is music that's aimed at girls, and is there something kind of anti-feminist or anti-girl in suggesting that it's intrinsically worthless or that it's of lesser merit than other kinds of music just because it's girls? I mean, do you see that as kind of a nefarious subtext in the denigration of boy bands?
Absolutely. I mean, look at how much other music we could accuse of being manufactured. I think the reason that boy bands are denigrated is because they are marketed to teenage girls and they're marketed as sex objects or at least romantic objects, and we tend to denigrate that. I think we're afraid of it, too.
All right, let's add Maura Johnston into the conversation. As I said before, Maura Johnston, writer, editor, and music critic, writes for the New York Times and Spin and teaches a class on popular music at Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. She's also preparing to launch Maura Magazine. Hey, maybe, Maura Johnston, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We haven't really kind of defined our terms here. Is there a way to talk taxonomically about what is a boy band?
I would say that a boy band is, you know, made up of, you know, five young men who, you know, make music that is pleasing aesthetically to the ear. So, you know, it would be like I Want It That Way by the Backstreet Boys or, you know, any of One Direction songs. You know, they're kind of upbeat. There's sort of a different character, you know, embraced by each member of the band. You know, there's the sexy one, the cute one, the goofy one, the silent one, you know, so that different people can be latched onto by the audience members. Yeah, as Amanda said, you know, they're also often, like, denigrated for, you know, having music that appeals to teenage girls. And I think, actually, you know, you could make the case that the Beatles were also, you know, a boy band in a way because, I mean, that you think of the Beatles coming to America and you see all those images of girls screaming and crying, you know, when they arrived. So obviously the core boy bands are like your NSYNCs or your One Directions or your Wanteds. But I do think that you can expand it to include bands like when I was in high school, when I was an adolescent, Guns N' Roses, you know, was sort of my boy band, one of my boy band surrogates, you know, because they also had the brooding one, the punk one, the goofy one, you know. So the core definition of it is probably a bunch of guys who, you know, can get together on stage and goof around. I was going to say dance, but One Direction doesn't really dance. They sort of just flop around on stage in time to the music.
Well, you know, let's stop on that for a second because, I mean, NSYNC, for example, they were some of these bands, they were terrific dancers. And they were really, really good at the dancing. But Amanda Hess, one thing that you point out is that One Direction has sort of almost a slightly postmodern take on itself in some ways. It seems like they're a little bit more in on the joke of being a boy band. At least that's your read on them, right?
Yeah, I do see the boys, as much as I can sort of divine their thoughts, as being a little bit more skeptical and cynical of these boy band tropes that they're, even as they're embodying some of them. And you see their fans really embodying that too. So if you look at Zayn, who is my favorite member, when he came up through the X Factor, he initially refused to do the dance portion of the audition because he said he thought it was stupid. If you watch the videos, you can also see, particularly Harry Styles, who's like the band's junior member, you see him adopt this kind of self-mocking face as he's doing the more boy bandish moves in the videos. And I think that's something that's really actually endearing to his fan base, who has these same, they have these same reservations about the over manufactured heartthrob too.
You know, even in that video Kiss You, there's sort of a joke about manufacture too. I think there's all these sort of Hitchcockian process shots of the bands, and they're on surfboards and they're on skis and stuff like that, but you can then sort of see the way it's being shot with a fake background and stuff like that, and there's sort of a big joke about that. But Maura Johnston, it does seem to me, just to go back to the origins and to go back to what you said about the Beatles, and I don't know if this prejudice is the one that has persevered through the decades, but certainly I am old enough to sort of remember that moment. And there was a sort of, there was a sense at that moment that there were these authorial bands, these songwriting bands that had emerged organically, often from working class British backgrounds. And so there were the Beatles and there were the Rolling Stones and perhaps there were even Herman's Hermits. I don't know if they ascend quite to the same level. But there were these bands that had emerged organically. And the rap against the Monkees, at least initially, was that they were assembled, that somebody had auditioned. By the way, you can win money in bars by knowing the fact that Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills, and Nash Nash auditioned unsuccessfully for the Monkees. But they had auditioned, and that there was something wrong with that, that that was contrary to the spirit of rock and roll, which should emerge somehow or other organically. I'll just throw that back to you.
You know, I think that there's a lot of myth-making in just music in general. And, I have sort of a hardline stance on that kind of thing where I say, you know, every artist that makes it to the mainstream, like, has some sort of interference from a label or, you know, a marketing division. Or the Beatles just didn't, like, call up Ed Sullivan and say, hey, can we be on your show, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's definitely that argument sort of holds weight, but I don't think it really does, because I just feel like you're getting into the whole myth-making of, like, what is real music and what isn't. And I feel like there's a lot more that goes on behind the scenes than people might want to admit or, you know, even be made aware of. You know, I understand, you know, obviously the Monkees had the auditions and they had the whole process of being made for TV. But, you know, I think also growing up in the early part of the MTV era, you see a lot of stuff that's just made for TV anyway. And I think that, you know, thinking about where the music is coming from too hard and also just denigrating it on that, is it really robs you of a lot of ability to be happy and surprised.
You know, and I'm playing devil's advocate by bringing that up. I mean, I'm a huge Monkees fan, and I abased myself even more than usual for this show by begging Peter Tork to come on the show, and he's not coming on the show. I think the fact that it was called Boy Bands may have done us in, but actually Jeff Timmons from 98 Degrees will be on the show a little bit later. The other thing I remember about the Monkees, and I will really embarrass myself now, I was maybe in sixth grade when the Monkees were really popular, and they had kind of a physical style, kind of a visual style, too. They weren't great dancers, but they had this kind of visual look, and they wore these kind of ski hats, these kind of knit hats, which they sort of wore on the back of their heads. And I'm sure they were bobby pinned into place, but I didn't understand that. And I was constantly trying to wear knit hats the way that they did. And I won't even say how old I was before I stopped doing that, but the number is bigger and more embarrassing than you can possibly imagine. And Amanda Hess, I'm going to throw this over to you. In some ways, another thing that boy bands do, I think, is kind of suggest what it is to be a boy at a given moment, too. Sort of what's a cute-looking, cool-looking boy at any given point in time. And they kind of freeze a point of time that way. I don't know. Am I onto anything there?
I think so. And I think they also reflect what it is to be a boy who's attracted to a girl, or who girls are attracted to at a certain point in time. The opera critic for the New York Observer attended the recent One Direction show in New York, and he sort of hilariously complained that they weren't dancing. And he was like, I know I'm surrounded by thousands and thousands of screaming girls, but he essentially said, I think they're wrong. This isn't sexy. And, you know, obviously they scream for themselves.
Right. You can't be wrong. You can't be wrong in this way. Maura Johnston, maybe also we need to not every NPR listener, oddly enough, is completely up to date on the subject that we're talking about right now, even with the inclusion of One Direction. So maybe you could just quickly explain One Direction. Their origin story is a little unusual, too, in the sense that they were kind of assembled from the discard bin of a different reality TV show, right?
Right. They all had auditioned individually on the X Factor UK. And Simon Cowell realized that they would probably work better together as a singular unit.
You know, we're going to take a quick break here and come back. Maybe we should play the Monkees. We have the Monkees theme song in there. Maybe as we get out of this segment, we can play the Monkees theme song just so I can have a little moment. Why should Amanda and Maura be the only ones getting glassy-eyed?
People say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to pull anybody down.
Maybe that's why every little thing I do never seems enough for you.
That, of course, is in sync. And Amanda Hess is here with us. Amanda, having read your stuff, I realized that we could get into a terrible fight because I used to think in that era, the way that I, as a somewhat older person, distinguished them, I had this belief that I don't really care what you do as long as you can actually do it and you can actually sort of realize it. And my perception, obviously completely wrong, was that NSYNC could do these things in a way that the Backstreet Boys could not. That watching them dance and watching them sing, I thought they just seemed vastly more competent than the Backstreet Boys. But I may have that wrong.
I'm also on Team NSYNC. But okay. I think what you're seeing with a band like One Direction, those boys, as much as I love them, they don't I don't think they sing as well as NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys did. They don't dance hardly at all. But one thing that I'm seeing is a lot of the fandom around them is not sort of based on their public performances or even the content of their songs as much as it is this sort of rich fantasy life about what their real lives are like. And that's something that started with their sort of exposure on a reality show like The X Factor, but is now really run by huge communities of women who, funnily enough, one of their biggest tropes of a lot of their fantasy is that the boys are actually in secret fights with their management constantly. Mm-hmm. So there's this boy band management that's trying to control their career, and the boys are sort of secretly fighting against this shadowy management force.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was interesting. I didn't realize that until reading your stuff, that there's this kind of part of the mythology now of One Direction is, and it is sort of the latest iteration of everything that we're talking about. It is that, yes, they're manufactured, but no, they don't want to be controlled by a Svengali, and they don't want to be manipulated, and they have this kind of true inner self that they are trying to locate and adhere to against the best efforts of the industry. And I love that as kind of a subplot about them. One thing I wanted to ask a little bit about, and by the way, we're going to talk in just a second to Tyler Gray, who can tell us a little bit more about those kinds of Svengalis and kind of one of them in particular. But a couple of quick points here. One of the interesting other subplots, I guess, of boy bands is that they are kind of a Darwinian process from which certain, you know, life forms emerge and other ones don't. So that, you know, you have Justin Timberlake coming out of NSYNC to go on to have an incredibly robust, perhaps the most robust post-boy band career. But you've got Bobby Brown coming out of a boy band. You've got Donnie Wahlberg coming out and having kind of a different kind of career. I mean, one of the sort of innate dark jokes of a boy band is pretty soon it's going to end, and some of you are going to fade into obscurity or do cruise ships, and some of you are going to go on and persist in certain ways. I'm not really asking a question, but I know you'll have something to say back to that.
Yeah, well, I think it is interesting to see exactly how and why these boys sort of graduate into men. And I think one of the key things is that they become accepted by other men. One thing that you saw Justin Timberlake doing hilariously and smartly is, I don't know if everyone remembers his SNL sketch that he did with Andy Samberg, the name of which I don't think I can say, but he...
I'm so grateful you're not even going to try.
He mocked boy bands publicly, and it was sort of a way for him to shed that sort of feminine world that he had been occupying before.
I think that's
the other way is
go ahead. Yeah.
Bands like the Beatles, you know, because they do play instruments and begin to write their own songs, they sort of become accepted in this sort of male music nerd world in a way that singers like most boy band members do not. I'd also say that, you know, if you look at the corollaries to these boys, if you look at female sex symbols, young women who come up as singers, I think that they might not get critical acclaim, but they can stay in the spotlight for as long as they remain sexually attractive to men. You don't really see people discounting someone like Rihanna or Beyonce so much for being manufactured or for not writing all of their own songs, because they can still sort of get on the cover of Esquire or GQ just because they're attractive women. And I'm not sure that the members of One Direction would be able to parlay that into a career.
It is sort of weird that, you know, it's harder to do this, the reverse of this, for a male audience. I think male audiences, for whatever reason, or guys are much more likely to cathect or you know, lock on to an individual female performer. But then you have sort of, I assume the Spice Girls were a completely manufactured entity, but guys didn't really go, oh, well, I like that Spice Girl. I mean, maybe some generation of guys did. I never really heard that, though, that they were sort of looking at the spice rack and figuring out, you know, which one that they gravitated towards. It just maybe isn't the way guys think or react to performers.
Well, that was also a band that was marketed to young women, and a lot of the girl bands are as well.
Yeah, sort of on a different basis. One last thing before we add Tyler Gray to this conversation. You know, Lisa Simpson is always reading a magazine called Non-Threatening Boys. You know, that's her sort of preferred tween magazine. So when I think of boy bands, I think, well, that's sort of what they are, right? That they're sexually kind of attractive, but in a very non-threatening way, not maybe a fully realized way. They're not Axl Rose. But I don't know. I mean, reading your stuff, Amanda, I sort of got the sense that there's more of a gradient there than I was aware of, more of a spectrum.
I think they can sort of start to test the waters a little bit. In that song that you played, Kiss You, you know, that song is sounds like it's about casual hookups. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't want to take it slow, you just want to take me home, mm-hmm. whatever. But I do think that songs, you know, for the most part, follow these really sort of traditional romantic tropes. But then off stage, which is something that the girls are really invested in, during the filming of The X Factor, when Harry was 16-year-old boy, he was rumored to be sleeping with one of the older female judges. And they all these boys have sort of like rich sexual and romantic lives off screen that these girls are really following. And they're also, you know, writing stories and projecting fantasies that are often much more sexual about these boys. They're sometimes even homosexual. And so the stuff that they're, the scenarios they're interested in putting these boys in, I don't think the record industry, you know, is necessarily taking in that far, but the girls certainly are in their own fantasies.
Let's add to this conversation Tyler Gray. Tyler Gray is editorial director for digital at Fast Company and the author of The Hit Charade, Lou Pearlman, Boy Bands, and the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in U.S. History. Tyler Gray, welcome to the show. You know, we've been talking about boy bands as though they were an entirely benign phenomenon, which for the most part are, but your work has kind of exposed a dark side to the boy band, at least in terms of this one guy, Lou Pearlman, who did assemble two of the boy bands that we've talked about, as well as some other kind of manufactured bands as well. First of all, welcome to the show. And second of all, tell us about Lou Pearlman. Who was this guy?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, I love it. A bunch of grown-ups talking about boy bands. Favorite way to spend an afternoon.
I've been looking forward to this show all week long.
Who was Lou Pearlman is the second part of that question?
Yeah.
That's a darn good question. I think I had the luck to get pretty close to the answer to that question. And that is, you know, he's a guy who has some very definite talents when it comes to selling anything. But in particular, he actually could recognize talent in young men in terms of singing and dancing and being able to shoulder a career in pop music. And he had a real knack for knowing exactly what the flavor of the moment was in pop music. And no matter what he did, be they fraudulent financial schemes or bilking people out of millions of dollars or creating an airline out of whole cloth that didn't really exist or any of the shenanigans that he pulled off, you can't take away the fact that the guy actually could recognize talent.
Although, you know, it's interesting. He doesn't come to this with a broad musical background. He comes to this with this interest in aviation, starting out with blimps and then with planes, and he's running some kind of, you know, charter service, and he winds up flying, I think, the New Kids on the Block, right? He winds
that,
up.
That was his story. Maurice Starr doesn't ever remember that, you know, who was the guy behind New Kids on the Block. But Lou swears that's true.
And that he just made some inquiries about the bottom line on New Kids on the Block and then thought, how hard could this possibly be?
Right. I mean, well, he did play guitar, I believe, and he sort of always wanted to, you know, he had a bit of a hankering to always be a performer, to be the center of attention, and he played guitar with the band for a while and palled around with the band from Queens and produced them for a while. And he sort of always had aspirations to be a member of a band. You know, to be frank, he just didn't have the body to match it.
No. Judging from your description of his body, I would assume that's not the case. Although that could be like a whole other boy band concept, maybe, that nobody's tried so far. Just like,
no, it's called it was called the Fat Boys. They were awesome.
All right. Okay, everything has been tried. I take it back. But anyway, he actually winds up having auditions first for Backstreet Boys and puts this whole thing together, then puts NSYNC together, then puts a whole bunch of these other perhaps less well-known groups together, including LFO, whose tune Summer Girls I do still remember. Now, part of the dark side of this is that everything else that he's doing is kind of made of smoke and mirrors, right? He does have an airline that just consists of almost no planes, right?
Right. Pretty much no planes. I mean, he ironically, the most real thing that Lou Pearlman ever did was boy bands. It's real easy to connect how he never would have had the cash to fund these bands and pursue this sort of massive disruption in the music industry at the time without the cash on hand that he got in gains from schemes that were fraudulent or illegal. And this is a guy who kind of horned his way into a blimp business, essentially owning and renting out a blimp to advertising companies, even though he kept crashing them, to somehow parlaying that into what he was calling an airline that he owned, but he actually never owned a fleet of planes. He took some people to a hangar and showed them planes that he never owned and claimed he did, and pulled all sorts of shenanigans to make it look like he owned these planes, and then took money from investors, lots of big names. But then that money got twisted into something called Transcontinental Records. The airline was called Transcontinental, and the record label became known as Transcontinental, and that became the label that found the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC.
The other dark and considerably more icky side of all this is in Tyler Gray, the author of The Hit Charade, Lou Pearlman, Boy Bands, and the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in U.S. History.
It was at the time. Then Bernie Madoff came, I should say. We need another edition.
This is an asterisk or something now. Yeah. But the narrative that you construct is chillingly familiar to anybody who's read about Jerry Sandusky or some of the scandals in the Roman Catholic Church. It turns out he's assembling these bands of really attractive young boys, and that's not an accident. He does appear to have an interest that goes well beyond music in them.
Yeah, and just how far that interest goes is really murky. I know there have been stories out there. Brian Burroughs and Vanity Fair went assembled a remarkable lineup of circumstantial evidence and, you know, made some claims that somebody may have found actionable, who knows. But The bottom line is that there were inappropriate things going on between Lou Pearlman and several of the artists that he worked with, the young artists that he worked with. Were they illegal things? I don't think anybody's ever been able to prove that. But it certainly was inappropriate. I think, I'm not a psychologist. I've talked to Lou some directly and indirectly. I've obviously studied a lot about him, and it seems like there's some sort of arrested development happening there. There's not a complete grown-up version of romantic adult love there. Mm-hmm. There's something going on that's just not fully formed. And I think that's what you saw in the strange scenarios that these boys found themselves in.
Amanda Hess, as you listened to all of this, I mean, you were initially sort of just the consumer of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, no matter how cynical and affected your middle school self wanted to be. Would knowing any of this stuff have mattered at all? Or is it kind of important maybe when you're in middle school and early high school not to know all this stuff and just kind of be able to bathe in the dream of these great-looking young guys singing these incredibly catchy songs?
I think it would make some things make a lot more sense to me, actually, because I think what you're seeing with the One Direction fan base now is that they're into the good-looking guys, they're into the catchy songs, but the narratives of these songs are, you know, sort of engineered and written by older men, and I don't think they necessarily really get what women are looking for in terms of romance, and the fact that, you know, Lou Pearlman himself seemed to have a bizarre view of that makes a lot of sense to me, because I really don't think they're experts on that part of the subject.
We're talking to Tyler Gray and Amanda Hess right now. We're going to be talking to Jeff Timmons from 98 Degrees in just a second. We got a call in here from Jeff in Guilford. Hi, Jeff.
The point I want to bring up is, you know, do most pop bands start as manufactured boy bands anyway? I mean, if you look at history of, you know, the Beatles, the Eagles, the Rascals, the Lovin' Spoonful, I mean, these are all seen as legit rock and roll Hall of Fame bands. But if you look at the history, I mean, you brought up even Stephen Stills tried out for the Monkees. But if you look at CSNY, you have sort of a perfect boy band. You have a Brit, you have a loner, you have a handsome one, you have a bluesy one. I mean, is that, you know, is the issue the ones that are good transcend and become legitimate bands in the end?
I think that may, I mean, I'll defer to the guest, although I do want to just sort of say one thing, because I haven't said it so far today, which is that, you know, as somebody who did grow up as a Monkees fan, they absolutely did transcend. And I've actually been getting tweets all during the show. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin, by the way. Somebody tweets, Larry tweets, don't sound so embarrassed. Clarksville, Daydream, and I'm a Believer were and remain perfect pop song car radio gems. I would add to that that at this point, they're even more than that, that the jazz singer Kurt Elling has a new CD out in which he does a sort of a bop edged version of Pleasant Valley Sunday, and the jazz singer Cassandra Wilson did Last Train to Clarksville. These are now melodies that have kind of crossed over. Now, a lot of these songs were written by real building songwriters, but the Monkees themselves also wrote some very interesting songs. A lot of people who watched Breaking Bad were thrust to the edge of their seats last season when this amazing song called Going Down, which is sung by Mickey Dolenz, just kind of over this kind of bass and drums groove, is used while they're cooking meth, and I'm sure 90% of the people watching the show had no idea where that song came from, but it's a Monkees song. The Monkees absolutely kind of transcended their status. But Amanda Hess, you know, his question is an interesting one, and he mentioned a whole lot of bands that end in L songs, Loving Spoonful and Eagle and Beatle and Crosby, Stills and Nashville. And I guess that is, I mean, maybe that is sort of the test, is do you become something else as you go along?
Sure. And I think it also, it helps for some bands like those, for us to be able to say, oh, they're, you know, they're a brilliant guitar player. That's why they have sort of persevered. Or they're great dancers. That's why they've survived. And this sort of confusion over One Direction, you know, they don't play instruments, they don't dance, I think has a lot to do with our idea that, you know, their charisma as sort of sex objects for young women is not a skill that we really value or even see as a skill.
One Direction reminds me of the Monkees a little bit in that way that they seem to be in on the joke. And there's some kind of goofy Harry Potter quality that they have, you know, that's kind of layered on top of the sexual appeal that I'm probably not picking up on, that I really like. That's kind of a little postmodern take on the whole thing.
You're revealing something about yourself.
Yeah, I've revealed so much about.
We all are.
I may not be able to work in this town after the show today. I've revealed so many things about myself. All right, we're gonna take a quick break here. We'll come back with more after this.
All right, so far I've raised $13.88 for Next in Line. I'm losing money just on hair product. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan, Patrick Scahill, and me, with help from Katie Kaplan. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bobby Brown. And now, back to Colin.
Actually, I feel as though our song for Next in Line, Food Court Love, I think it has potential. I mean, it's not as good as the One Direction song, but it's good. And it's certainly not as good as some of the big hits that 98 Degrees had. 98 Degrees, I believe I can call them a boy band. They are. They were a boy band, and they were a great boy band. Joining us is one of their members, Jeff Timmons. Jeff Timmons, I don't know how much of our show today you've had a chance to listen to, but one thing that was talked about early on is that most boy bands are the products of auditions. But my sense in reading about 98 Degrees is that your origin story is really kind of different from some of the bands that we've talked about, that you evolved a little bit more organically. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. You know, it's funny. Obviously, with any act on any major record label, you're going to have some packaging and things of that nature after you get signed. I mean, and you can have the most organic, most talented artist that can play all the instruments on the planet, but ultimately, they're going to find out what works and start to cater to that with their A&Rs and product managers there at the labels. But with us, no. We put ourselves together. We modeled ourselves after Boys to Men, which we thought was a tremendously amazing, vocally talented band. And we wanted to get signed to Motown, and we did. You know, we did that and got ourselves signed. We put ourselves together. So we were a little bit different in that respect.
I want to ask the obvious question, and I'm sure the answer is an hour long, but what's it like? What's it like to be one of those guys who's up there on stage and people are just screaming and screaming with excitement that you're just even there? Is it possible to have any kind of detachment from that and kind of look at it with amusement, or is it just overwhelming and engulfing?
It's kind of both at the same time. And yeah, no, I mean, you never get tired of that. You never get tired of screaming fans, the accolades that come along with that. You know, I still, to this day, whenever I go any place, I still get recognized. And people will tell you, oh, I hate it. It's not fun. But you get into that for that. You get into it for the music. You get into it for a number of reasons, the girls, the money, and just to have success, to follow your dream or whatever, of being a pop star. But it never gets old. It's always exciting. And you get to catch at some point when you're tired, after you've been on the road for maybe 4 or 5 years straight, it starts to become, you know, your job, and you're up there on stage and you're going through the motions in some part, but there's always that little fire in there that keeps you excited and wanting to perform at all times.
I want to make sure my friends Amanda Hess and Tyler Gray get to ask you questions as well, but I'll give them a second to think about what their question is going to be. And Jeff Timmons from 98 Degrees, as you watch whatever the next big thing is, and right now it's One Direction, are you thinking certain thoughts towards them, like, I got to warn you guys, or I can see what's happening right now, and I want to give you the benefit of my wisdom over the years. Are there thoughts that you're having as a veteran of this that the average person wouldn't have?
I think so, because you get so busy so quick. Everything happens so fast, Colin, that it becomes a whirlwind for you. You know, one day we were starving on the streets and, you know, then got signed. And, you know, the next day, you know, all of a sudden we can't get out of our tour bus. And when that stuff happens, you all of a sudden get so busy. You're on the road, you're doing promo tours, you're doing in stores, you're doing radio appearances like we're doing right now, and it just doesn't stop. And in that process, you forget about the business part of things, which is, at the end of the day, it is the music business. So the most important part is, you know, you're in this to make some money, and you know, you're making other people lots of money. And in that process, you need to really pay attention to the people you have in place around you. So when I'm seeing these guys blow up, I'm like, I hope they have the proper management team, proper lawyers, proper accountants, proper business management to watch out for what they're doing. Because when you become a pop star, you're making somebody a lot of money. And the more money you're making them, they're putting into your project and behind you. And you're the prop. You're out there. You're the artist. You're creating the music. But ultimately, there are people making money off of you at all times. So you want to make sure you can at least have a little part of that.
Amanda Hess, did you have something you wanted to, I don't know how many conversations you've had with actual real life band members like this, but did you have a question for Jeff Timmons?
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff, did you ever find that you experienced any ridicule either from, you know, friends or critics because your fan base was made up of really young women?
I started receiving ridicule from my friends and stuff like that. I'm from a really small town in Ohio that was it's a world-renowned football town called Maslin. So, you know, when I decided, and I tried to play football and play in college and everything like that, when my career was over and I wasn't going to be an NFL player and I started to become a singer, I received ridicule just from the jump when I started the group, put it together, and then went to California. That was unheard of and kind of taboo for where I'm even from. So I started receiving ridicule. You're always going to receive ridicule when you follow a dream or something that somebody else is afraid to do.
But I think her question also is, and we talked about this at the beginning of the show, you know, boy bands sometimes do come in for a certain kind of criticism. And we were wondering whether in fact the music and the artist is devalued because it's for young girls. And if that's almost kind of an anti-feminist stance, because young girls like you so much, you can't be as good as ABC or XY.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, well, I guess we're cast in that kind of a light. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you this, I would be surprised if any of the members of any of the boy bands would really have complaints about any of that. you're going to receive ridicule, but you know, those guys in Backstreet Boys and Boys to Men or NSYNC, those guys can all sing. I mean, the majority of those guys can sing, and they do have talent. They might not play instruments, but if you ask a record label what their target demographic is, it's always teen girls. No matter what the act is, it could be a heavy metal act. They're going to try to skew to that demographic because those are the buying demographics. The teen girls are the buying demographics. The major players in supporting music in the industry are teen girls. So it might not be overt to you because the guys might have long hair, might play instruments, might be rockers or whatever, but the labels are always targeting those girls.
And Tyler Gray, did you have a question for Jeff Timmons?
Yeah, hey, Jeff. I'm always interested in that moment where, like, you know, you guys try to stretch beyond what it is you're supposed to be doing, or you butt up against someone else's vision of what's supposed to be the package that you're putting out there. Did you ever experience those growing pains where you wanted to go in a certain direction and you had, you know, maybe it was Lou or maybe somebody said, you know, no, you need to do this, you know, go to this mall, do this, and you thought, we have this one song that we want to write, you know, it's got a different topic and a different feel. Did you ever feel any pushback like that?
Of course, that's a great question, by the way. You know, we started kind of the opposite way, and we got signed to Motown, and Motown wanted to do completely the opposite thing that happened with the Backstreet Boys. Motown wanted us to be more urban, have more swag. In fact, they wanted to take our Ohio hillbilly butts and move us to Harlem so we could get more flavor and be more urban. And so that was their kind of way of putting us out there because we were singers. I mean, we were a vocal chamber group. We sang a cappella. We sang R&B music first. Our first album is almost all R&B.
they actually did it the opposite way. We wanted to be more like the Backstreet Boys and do that. Of course, we wanted to have our R&B flavor, but like the Four Tops, the Four Seasons, and Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. But they shifted us towards a more deeper R&B thing, and then we ended up coming back. When the president of Motown got fired, the other guy said, okay, look, these are four white guys that are good looking. Let's move them down kind of like a more vanilla path. And we sort of resisted that at first, and then, you know, we adopted it. So it was, for us, the opposite direction. They took us the other way before we even came out, and then we ended up doing what we wanted there in the end.
I've got a call here from Jen Cook, whose email I've been quoting. Jen Cook calling in from East Granby. Hi, you're on the air.
I wanted to touch on another thing I've emailed is about how you need economic power within teen girls for this business model to work.
Mm-hmm.
So cultures like South Korea, that means South Korean girls have money to spend, and South Korean girls have time where they get to spend it with each other to create the culture, the subculture of fantasizing about the boys, choosing which boy is your boy, the cute one, the chunky one, the nerdy one. So you need a certain amount of power for women within a culture for that to happen.
It's a really great point that it's actually kind of the sign of a robust female youth culture that there can be such a thing as a boy band, and that it can have that kind of appeal. Jen Cook, by the way, thanks for the email. It was really very helpful for me in shaping some of the thoughts for this show. And it's been so great to visit with Jeff Timmons from 98 Degrees and with Amanda Hess, who often writes for Slate. Maura Johnston was with us. She's a writer, editor, and music critic for the New York Times and Spin. Who did I miss? Tyler Gray, editorial director of Digital Fast Company and author of The Hit Charade. Lou Pearlman, Boy Bands and the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in U.S. History. Asterisk, not really, not anymore. Thanks especially to Betsy Kaplan, who put this show together. We'll be back tomorrow.
My name is Kyone Wolf. I'm sorry to tell you that One Direction couldn't make it tonight. Instead, I'd like to present Next in Line. Nothing? Ticket refunds are available at the box office.